Tony Basilio now joined by noted author John McMillan. His work, Beatles versus the Stones from Simon & Schuster. Let me tell you something. If you're a fan of rock music, the Beatles or the Stones, or you're like me and you're just a casual fan of both and recognize the greatness of both, this is a wonderful work as John McMillan now joins us. John, how you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much.
Hey, first things first, man. Congratulations on this. What an interesting read. What a great concept. And it looks like the way you build this, almost like we're going to see a prize fight here, the Beatles versus the Stones, and you're the promoter.
Right. Well, that was my publisher's idea for the cover. Well, this book grew out of my first book. My first book was called Smoking Typewriters, and it was on the underground press in the 1960s and early 70s. And I don't know if you're familiar, but, you know, in the late 60s, there were all these radical and countercultural and political tabloids throughout the country. And when I was researching that book, there was a very interesting debate about the Beatles and the Stones, maybe circa 1968, regarding their different political stylings. And the Beatles were thought to be the more gentle band that members of the counterculture glommed onto, and the Stones were thought to be the more, you know, radical street-fighting group. And in fact, neither band was very political throughout most of the 60s, but there was an interesting debate about the supposed ideological differences between the Beatles and the Stones. And so that sort of fed its way into the book. I wrote an article on that topic, and then from there, that's the entire book, which explores the whole rivalry in different manifestations.
And one of the manifestations is this. The Beatles sold all these records. They had all this fame. Folks of all generations love them, all ages. During the 8 years that they were alive and doing their thing, and during that period, the Beatles sort of resented, especially John Lennon, the fact that the Stones were seen as the group, and you elaborate on this, they were sort of seen as the group with the hipsters, the in crowd, the folks you're talking about, the politically minded folks. They were really embraced, where the Beatles were kind of seen as a kiddie group.
Yeah, that's right. You know, especially in the early 60s in England, the Stones were big champions of American blues from Mississippi and Chicago and so on. And that was kind of a niche genre. That wasn't something that was terribly popular in the UK. The people who listened to the blues were mostly bohemians and art students and people who were a bit like maybe modern day hipsters, people who thought they had some superior, you know, cultural knowledge. And early on, the Stones were almost evangelicals for this aesthetic. So they were concerned with that, and then they thought that the Beatles, by contrast, were trying to please everyone. I mean, mostly they focused their energy on satisfying the tastes of young, very young girls, but they were also embraced by all elements of society, by adults, by politicians, by members of the royal family, by newspaper editors. So according to some disaffected youth, that made the Beatles compromisers or sellouts. The Beatles were just the group that was going to be popular with everyone. The really discerning types, the hipsters, were going to tend to support the Stones.
John McMillan, our guest. Beatles versus the Stones is the work. And you say this kind of grew out of an article that you wrote, and really one that when you were looking at the impact from the music scene, in particular these two groups, on a lot of what was there in terms of the underground press. Let me ask you, as you delve deeper, give me a couple surprises to you that you thought were interesting.
Well, you know, I knew a fair bit about both groups before I started the project, but I think I was surprised a little bit by the degree to which the class differences between the Beatles and the Stones mattered so much in British society. Southern England, Northern England back then, and even to some degree today, were very much like two separate countries, really. And people from the South, from London, really looked down on Northerners where the Beatles were from. They thought that the Beatles were kind of coming from Liverpool, that was economically depressed city, and it was kind of a culturally barren wasteland. And people from London looked at Liverpool the way someone from maybe New York City or Cambridge, Massachusetts might unfairly stereotype someone from the Deep South. It was unfair, but there was a kind of snobbishness in the Stones' attitude. And the degree to which that affected their relationship maybe early on was a big surprise. And then I was also interested in learning some of the class distinctions within the groups. And so for the Beatles, for instance, of the four Beatles, John Lennon was the only one in the group who came from a home that had running water. And of course, that's not quite as surprising as it might seem when you consider that they were growing up in post-World War II England in Liverpool, which was, you know, very much attacked by the Germans. But nevertheless, the Beatles had these very hardscrabble backgrounds. whereas on balance, the Stones came from a more suburban environment.
Yeah, to build on that point, the Stones made a concerted effort early on, image-wise, to distance themselves from the fact that some of these guys were silver-spooned, and they almost presented themselves to the world as if they had the Beatles background. It was an interesting juxtaposition when you think about it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics, which is, of course, a very prestigious school, and he went there at a time when only about 2% of British kids went on to study at universities, and he was very much being groomed for an elite career in politics or business or law, perhaps. And Brian Jones could have done much the same. He was an outstanding student. His parents were upper middle class, and he did very well on his exams in grammar school. And if he had wanted to go on to a very selective British university, he could have done so. But they were both taken in by the blues. And for Brian Jones, you know, being in a blues band was pretty much a way of life for him. And he sort of turned his back on some of his class privilege. I think Mick Jagger was a little more calculated. I think he was interested in being in this band, and he wanted to go to school. But when he saw the potential for the Stones to do well, he decided to take a break from his studies. And as it turned out, he never went back.
And furthermore, what I think is really interesting is the connections between these groups as well. You point this out. The media went out of their way to try and create a rivalry between the two. But there really wasn't a rivalry, but there were so many connections. These two groups were interwoven, going right down to both managers and the fact that the Stones manager got his start under Brian Epstein. It's interesting, isn't it?
Sure, sure. I mean, there was some competition between the groups. I describe it in the book as either a competitive friendship or a creative rivalry. On the one hand, they really enjoyed each other's company, and they genuinely admired, each group admired what the other one was doing, so they could bond over their shared experiences and whatnot. And yet, at the same time, they never stopped trying to outcompete each other in various ways. And they were quite intimate. You know, England, the music scene in England was a lot smaller than it is now. There were really only two main recording companies, EMI and Decca. The Beatles were with the first, and the Stones were with Decca. But yeah, there were interconnections between their management. The Stones manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, got his start doing PR work for Brian Epstein. And so there were all these insinuations and connections, and they hung out quite a bit. In the early 60s, and then again, sort of in the swinging London era, they were seen a lot together.
The account you have of Mick Jagger and how much he hated being upstaged. In fact, about Mick Jagger, let's point something out. You say that the accent that he spoke in much of the time, I don't know exactly how you describe that, but you say that was a put on through the work that you've been able to find. But if you can, elaborate on that, but share the story about the time that Hey Jude was played in his presence and how that all went.
1968, I think in the summer of that year, Mick Jagger turned 26, I think, and he flew all the way from Los Angeles to London for a birthday party. It was going to be held in his honor, and it was a very swanky and exclusive club. It was full of models and pop stars and artists, and as a special treat, he brought along for everyone an advanced copy of the Stones' forthcoming record, Beggar's Banquet, which hadn't been officially released, but it would soon win accolades as maybe the best Stones album to date. And everyone was leaping around and celebrating the record. It was a real hit with the crowd. But then John Lennon and Paul McCartney strolled in, and they brought an advanced pressing of a forthcoming 45 that had Hey Jude on one side and John Lennon's song Revolution on the other. And then when they played that, it seemed that the crowd really went wild, and they just demanded that the Hey Jude be played over again and again. And by many accounts, Mick Jagger seemed a little bit peeved because he felt the Beatles had upstaged him at his own birthday party.
We talked about the political overtones that folks wanted to project on both these groups, even though they were pretty much, when you get right down to it, in that heyday, especially the turbulent 60s, they were pretty much apolitical. Folks heard Revolution and they thought, man, this is about us, when really Lennon was saying the opposite, wasn't he?
Revolution was sort of thought to be a put down of the more militant elements of the new left. This is the time of a lot of turbulence in the United States and around the world in 1968. Urban insurrections and assassinations and marches turning violent and lootings, and there was a kind of street fighting element among the new left that really wanted to
smashed the system, and they were saying that American society was rotten at its core and had to be completely re-overhauled. And Revolution chides them a little bit and suggests that things are going to be okay, and he's not really ready to join that revolutionary front. That was his statement. The music is kind of abrasive and jarring, but the political message in that song is almost apolitical.
And what's interesting is John Lennon was extremely sensitive to criticism, wasn't he?
Oh my gosh, he sure was, yeah. He got in feuds with activists who otherwise wouldn't be very well known. If they criticized him in an underground newspaper, he was inclined to maybe write a rebuttal. He's an interesting figure politically because I think John Lennon was a very, very smart man, but he was not terribly well educated and he wasn't terribly well informed. So he never really developed a very coherent political philosophy. He would contradict himself pretty frequently, and he just didn't really know the score regarding the political goings-ons in that era.
John McMillan is our guest. His book, John McMillan Presents Beatles versus Stones. I'm telling you, we are scratching the surface here as we talk with him because there's so much stuff in the book. In fact, the way you set the book up is you say, look, I'm not going to make a determination as to who's better. You want to make that determination, you make that determination. And you basically tell their stories coinciding with each other during that time period. And, you know, one thing that I found as I read, and I've read some stuff on the Stones before, but I don't know why your portrayal of Brian Jones really kind of had me feeling sorry for him all over again. Here's a guy that started the Stones, kept the dream alive early on before the record deal, and basically had his group metamorphosize right out from under him and the control taken away from him, essentially, right?
Yeah, it's tough with Brian Jones because, you know, on the one hand, as you say, he was the one who had the pluck and the determination to found the Rolling Stones. He got the group together and, you know, he worked very hard in the early years to get them some attention. But he had a kind of antisocial personality. He was extremely difficult to work with. He would plot against other members in the band. He would undermine the people. He would try to, he always insisted that he should be the leader of the group and the biggest star, which of course with Mick Jagger and the band was kind of a ludicrous, you know, proposition. And so he undermined himself within the group. And, you know, one of the differences between the Beatles and the Stones is that the Beatles were seen as a, you know, a communal gang, as a kind of, as a group. And they all seemed to get along really well. Their personalities complemented each other. And the Stones were never that kind of an outfit. They were never very trusting with each other to stay bonded, you know, over a prolonged and difficult period. So there were different rivalries within the group, and Jones was eventually pushed out. The thing that really hurt his cause later on was the fact that he was got so deep into drugs that he also lost his ability to contribute very much musically.
Yeah, contribute and really even function on stage, right? I mean, they got frustrated with him.
Yeah, he would show up late for rehearsals or miss rehearsals. He may have been a kind of hypochondriac. And by the end, he was just so wiped out with drugs that he was just a ghost of his former self.
I'll tell you another thing that really caught me off guard as we visit with John McMillan, Beatles versus the Stones, from Simon & Schuster. Check it out. The utter cruelty through your research that you attribute to John Lennon in his youth and to his early 20s. We look at John Lennon now, this bespeckled figure that was all about peace and I love you and you love me. But man, you talk about how this guy would go out of his way to ridicule even the least among us. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say about John Lennon is that he did display some pretty remarkable capacities for growth over the course of his life. So at least the John Lennon that we saw sort of in his later years was a more gentle and compassionate soul than the John Lennon that was growing up. And he also had a very tough life, so you take those things into consideration. But sure, he had a tendency to really want to hurt people's feelings, and he had a keen ability to figure out someone's seductive point or also their vulnerable point. And if you wanted to make someone feel bad, he knew exactly what buttons to push. And so he was very skilled at kind of verbal combat and putting people down and making them feel bad.
I don't know why that shocked me. I've always read that he was sort of a fighter and, you know, he was a tough guy and this and that. And you look at him and you go, that guy was a tough guy? I mean, you got to be kidding me. But the stuff that you write, and folks will have to dig deep, but there are some accounts in there and you just kind of go, man, that seems completely incongruent with the guy that he became. So, as you say, good for him, things do evolve. Let me throw this at you. Decca's passing on the Beatles, they, you would have to think inside, and you talk about this, were hell-bent to not let that happen again on the next big thing. How much do you feel like them passing on the Beatles helped the Stones get the push from that record company that they got and became such a worldwide sensation?
It's hard to say for sure, but I would suspect it mattered a great deal. The fact is, Decca passed on the Beatles, and so the Beatles signed with EMI, and then Beatlemania hit, and they became a huge success. And also, as a result of the Beatles' success, all the other up-and-coming groups wanted to sign with EMI because they wanted to have this prestige of being on the same label as the Beatles. So Decca was very much in the lurch, and they were very much looking for an answer to the Beatles or the next big thing, as you were suggesting. And so when the Stones came along, I think they were very desperate to sign them, and they did it very quickly, and they gave the Stones actually a better royalty rate than the Beatles got. And the Beatles sold many more records and ultimately made more money, I suppose, but the Stones got the better record deal, in part because Decca just did not want to be left in the lurch again.
I'll tell you what was really interesting is your account. Here the Beatles come to America, and they conquer America, and they, you know, the British invasion. If anything, the Stones had a really soft landing in this country, didn't they? Folks here did not get them their first time through, did they?
Certainly not in the heartland. Their first American tour was strange because they actually did pretty well in New York City and also in Southern California, where some people had heard them and they had a bit of a cult following that was building up. But when they went to places in the middle of the country, they did not get the Stones at all. The Stones, you know, they had the long hair and the lousy attitudes, and American audiences weren't prepared for them. And then also the bookings in that first tour were not very favorable to the Stones. Sometimes they were, you know, billed, they were meant to play at these, you know, variety shows or rodeos or places where you wouldn't normally expect the, you know, hip and plugged in teams to go. So they had a tough time, but they later said that it helped make them a much better band because they had to, once again, they had to really work hard to try to win over those American audiences. And so that may have sharpened some of the skills as well.
I would imagine that'd be shocking now for people to hear that the Stones really had to earn it in the heartland, in America, because you would think, man, you had a chance to see the Stones back then. And I would imagine people in the audience then were thinking, well, I mean, who in the world are these guys? They'll be here now, and 6 months later, they'll be gone.
Sure. Well, that was, you know, there were so many, you know, not quite one-hit wonders, but bands that came and went really quickly. Then lots of other bands coming from England, of course. The British invasion was happening. It was by no means a sure thing that the Stones were going to last for 50 years. I mean, no one would have thought that was possible. And so it would have been hard to predict what would have happened for the Stones in the future.
The whole concept of a rivalry notion that existed and was perpetuated by the media, it was really driven home, though, by the fan bases, particularly, it seems, by Stones fans who, I don't know if they saw the Beatles as just too commercial. You know, we hear that today. You know, that music's too commercial. Mm-hmm. You see that in Nashville now. A lot of the old country folks will look at new country and go, that is just way too commercial. I'm not fooling with that. You guys are sellouts. But you say, and it's on page 102 in your book, there were even places where they said, hey, this is for Stones fans only. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, just, you know, people, as you were saying, people constructed their images differently, and the Beatles were thought to be the group that won approval from all levels of society, whereas the Stones are the more radical or renegade outfit. And yeah, there was at least one nightclub where they put a sign on the door that said Stones fans only. They didn't want Beatles fans going there. And I've talked to a lot of people who said you could tell pretty quickly if you met someone just by the way they styled themselves and the way they dressed, whether they were likely to be Beatles or Stones. And, you know, so, of course, you could like both groups. But a lot of people, music fans, that you had to, you know, make a choice in this period and identify with one group or the other. And you could tell what kind of, you know, social type of person was by what their affiliation was musically.
You feel like that continues today?
A lot less, I think, because, you know, the Beatles and the Stones are so widely accepted by everyone now. And the Stones are a great case in point. It's astonishing to think how dangerous and radical they once seemed, to the point where parents were very much up in arms about the Stones, and they thought the Stones were a big menace to society, and they didn't want their kids listening to the group. Whereas nowadays, you know, baby boomers are probably the biggest audience for the Rolling Stones. They're the only ones who can afford to see them at the ticket prices that they charge. So I think a lot of the rivalry was historically contingent. It was focused on the 60s. It's not as pervasive today.
The rivalry amongst themselves, and I guess we'll never know this, but the one thing I wondered as I read your account, when you think about the Stones and how adventuresome and great their stuff was in the late 60s, and the Beatles in that time period pushing the envelope with the psychedelic stuff and all the drugs and all the things that they were into, you know, you look back on that time period and you almost get the sense that those groups were both really pushing each other. Do you kind of feel that way?
Yes, I do. Although this book focuses on the Beatles and the Stones, but I do mention that there was a lot of other things going on as well. There are groups like the Beach Boys and the Kinks and the Who, and all of these groups were trying to, they were keeping close tabs on each other and trying to step ahead of each other. And certainly the Beatles, though, were the group that I think was the most audacious in the 60s, regardless of which group you liked the most. The Beatles were so pioneering, and you know, every record from 1965 onward, let's say, was a big sonic and expressive leap forward. And so other groups began to become more audacious, too, in the Beatles' wake. And that led to a great deal of experimentation and ingenuity in the pop world back then.
Yeah, and some of it worked, and some of it didn't. And the Stones found that out. They had a work there in the late 60s you talk about that was panned. Sometimes you throw something out there and it doesn't work.
You're talking about their Satanic Majesty's Request. That came out maybe about 6 months after the Beatles record, Sgt. Pepper. And I don't know if Sgt. Pepper was the best Beatles record, but it was the most broadly acclaimed album in history. And that was, of course, kind of a psychedelic type record. And so the Stones wanted to move in this direction as well. And they tried to make a sort of psychedelic styled record. And it, that just did not suit what the Stones were really doing. That wasn't what they were about. So that record has some defenders today, but most people back then thought it was kind of a flop. And I think the Stones would agree as well.
Yeah,
although it does have one great song, She's a Rainbow.
Yeah, and you know, the media folks were just ripping it to shreds back in the day, as you talk about. You know, I'll tell you something else that I think is really interesting. We talked about those managers before. Both those guys projected to the outside world, a couple of young guys that were all together. Both those guys internally were combusting. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, I think they, like a lot of pop acts in the 60s, they too had to deal with burdens and strains of this enormous overnight success. And they both also coped with drugs, just the way a lot of pop and rock acts did. So there's a lot of new stuff coming up on Brian Epstein. He was just a very, in some ways, he was too trusting, and he was a little bit insecure. He was always worried that the Beatles were going to find another manager and move on. And he really required their affection. And so he had all sorts of insecurities. And so he was a taker of drugs. And then Andrew Lou Goldham, I think he just got carried away a little bit with the fun and glamorous aspects of the swinging London scene, and he took it a bit too far. So he undermined his position with the Stones as well with his drug use.
John McMillan is our guest, and I literally read this book three times, and I recommend it to you. It's called Beatles versus the Stones. It's from Simon & Schuster, and another point that I really want to cover here, because I think it was just so interesting, and that you got to this. And the fact that this book grew out of your work about the underground press makes sense that you tackled this angle. The Stones were more embracing toward and more embraced by the left of these two groups, as we talked about. But those folks came to see the Stones, especially in the late 60s, as greed mongers. Hey, they're not really
right
with us. These guys are really capitalist at the end of the day, which is like one of the worst things you could say about somebody to many of those people back then. Imagine them wanting to make money. If you can, the account of what happened in Philadelphia in 69, and then how that criticism ended up turning into the real debacle at Altamont.
Mm-hmm. For a very long time, since 1969, I think the Stones have really been at the forefront of charging more for their tickets than almost any other group. And when they started doing this in the late 60s, they were on the one hand trying to telegraph to youths that they were part of this insurgent movement and that the Stones were on the side of rebellious youths, but at the same time, their ticket prices were more expensive than anyone else's. And they greeted a lot of their fans with a kind of rock star arrogance. They would show up late for their shows. They had these security guards who acted like goons. They wouldn't give interviews to local papers. They were acting like prima donnas. And so all this criticism really began to bite them in the butt in the late 60s. And so then they decided to do this Altamont concert, which is in December of 1969. And that was, of course, the free show near San Francisco that was meant to kind of rival Woodstock. The Stones wanted to put on a free show that would win loyalty from a lot of their fans. And it would be, they would make a movie out of it, so they'd make some money. And it was supposed to be a really peaceful and groovy scene. But of course, the Altamont show was a big fiasco. They hired the Hell's Angels to guard the stage, and the Hells Angels went on a kind of rampage, and they beat a lot of people up, and then ultimately a young African-American in front of the stage was murdered with a knife right as the Stones were playing. And then, of course, that's captured on film in the Stones film Gimme Shelter.
Many people look at that in terms of rock history as the end of the peace and love movement and the beginning of the deep, dark 70s.
That's exactly right. I mean, Woodstock seemed to symbolize to a lot of people the utopian aspects of the 60s counterculture and the peace and love vibe, as you mentioned. But Altamont had a completely counter vibe, and Altamont is lumped up there with, you know, Charles Manson and the Weather Underground and other dark currents that are meant to symbolize the end of the 60s.
Help me understand this as I read your work, because I want to make sure I understood it, because I had to read this a couple times. I'm a little dense, okay? Why didn't Mick Jagger and the rest of the Rolling Stones protect the Beatles from rogue American accountant Alan Klein, who ended up robbing both of them blind? That seems like a pretty horrible thing to do to somebody that you like or that you see in a positive light. Why would he allow that to go on?
Yeah, well, there are some competing claims about what precisely happened, but my account holds that, you know, the Stones hired Alan Klein because they looked favorably upon him, and he had a good reputation as being just a very brash and aggressive accountant who could make him a lot of money. But then they realized that Alan Klein was a bit of a crook. He wasn't a bit of a crook. He was a thief for sure. And one terrible thing he did was he got the Stones to sign away the rights to a lot of their own music. Mm. And he really double-crossed them. And my theory is that Mick Jagger decided that he wanted to disentangle the Stones from Alan Klein's grip. And the only way to do that was to get Alan Klein involved with the Beatles. And the Beatles was the group that Alan Klein always really wanted to manage the most. You know, the Stones were number two, and the Beatles were number one in his eyes because the Beatles had more money to play around with. So it's likely, I think, that Mick Jagger sort of was silent, and he let the Beatles connect themselves with Klein, so that allowed him to break away from Alan Klein.
And Klein ended up doing some damage to the Beatles, too, didn't he?
Sure, and both groups ended up suing him, and the lawsuits went on for many, many years. And I think it took 17 years before the Stones were finally able to disentangle themselves completely from Alan Klein. The Stones' best-selling record is actually a compilation album, Hot Rocks, and not all that money went into Alan Klein's pockets because by that point he had won control of the copyright of all of those songs.
That's just a remarkable thing that a Stones fan has to shake their head at and go, how in the world could that be? But that's the way it's always been in the music business. If these artists don't protect themselves and find people around them who will protect them, they're going to get it. In fact, you paint an account about Klein, and he was sniffed out by the father of who we came to know as Linda McCartney, who was Linda Eastman at the time. And he was pretty ruthless in the way that he shot down the father of Linda Eastman. Share that.
Well, Paul McCartney wanted his girlfriend or his wife's father to manage the Beatles.
Not the Beatles. Mm-hmm.
And John and Paul and George simply were not going to go along with that. There were some very tumultuous meetings where Alan Klein was trying to undermine Lee Eastman's position. And then just one odd thing that Alan Klein found out, he must have hired a private investigator to find out that Lee Eastman, his last name previously was Epstein, like Brian Epstein. Mm. And he had probably anglicized his name like a lot of people did when they wanted to come over to the U.S. They were immigrants and they wanted to work hard and be successful. So they anglicized their Jewish names. And that was just an odd thing that he dug up, again, probably because he was looking for dirt on Lee Eastman.
That's some pretty ruthless stuff right there. Hey, John, I really appreciate your time. Let me close here with you. I found it very interesting. McCartney and Jagger, who emerged as the two leaders of these two groups, whether it started that way, it didn't in either case, but these are the two guys that emerged as the two dominant forces. They were looking to join business ventures, the Stones and Beatles at one time, but it never came to be. I thought that was an interesting anecdote.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that they had thought about starting a record label together jointly. And they had some conversations where they talked about how fun it would be to, you know, combine forces in that respect. They had some pretty grandiose plans, but it never got past the conversation stage. And in fact, it was Alan Klein who threw a wet towel on the whole idea because that would have maybe undermined his position. But it was something that was bruited about, and the press was always trying to find some way to get the Beatles and the Stones together, whether in the recording studio or on stage or whatnot, and that never happened. But it was talked about quite a bit, especially in the late 60s.
So, John, let me ask you this on the way out. Who's better, Beatles versus Stones? Who wins?
You know what? I don't mean to be impolite. I actually do have a preference, but I haven't said in the book or in any of my media stuff, because I don't want people to get focused on my own aesthetic preferences. And as I say in the book, I'm not really a rock critic. I'm a historian, and I'm interested in how this rivalry was constructed by fans and by people in the media and by the groups themselves. But writing rock criticism is not really my skill set, and lots of other people have wagered opinions on that question. And I was just trying to write a more historically informed book rather than a book that focuses on aesthetics. So I have to decline to answer the question, but I appreciate it. I knew it was coming, too.
I'm not doing my job if I don't ask you that. And let me say, for the sake of your work, you did an excellent job in untangling many of these interwoven facets of these two groups that dominated much of that tumultuous period, and they were both forces and remain so to this day. And may I say this, one other point that you bring up that really had me thinking is the Beatles are like James Dean in a lot of ways. They left works. Of course, they left a little more than James Dean left, but what I mean is they died young and left a good corpse, as the old saying goes. The Stones, they've stuck around at the party too long, but what are they going to do? They're musicians. They're going to keep playing, and they've got tremendous audiences. And you make the case that it's almost easy to look at the Stones now and go, these are the Stones now versus when they did what they did. And when you take that time period, I mean, these two groups were really smoking at that point in time, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles were successful throughout the 60s, and when they broke up in 1970, they were still very much near the height of their power. Their last album, Abbey Road, was still a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
The Stones also had a great run in the late 60s, especially, oddly, around the time the Beatles broke up. It seemed like the Stones stopped trying to use the Beatles as a creative template, and they started focusing on their own strongest medium, which is blues-inflected rock. And between 68 and 1972, the Stones put out five albums that a lot of rock fans think are five of the best albums in history. But then they proceeded to kind of dilute their catalog with a bunch of mediocre records over the years. And that's something the Beatles never did.
John, really, really appreciate your time again. Great talking with you, and congratulations on this work. And I'd love to have you back, man, as you do some more stuff. What's your next project? Do you have anything going right now?
First of all, thank you very much for the kind words. I really enjoyed the interview as well, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I appreciate it. My next book is totally unrelated, but it's on Gary Trudeau and his comic strip Doonesbury. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's going to be a biography of this political cartoon.
Wow, how interesting. When will that come out?
Oh, gosh, I don't have a contract yet for it, and I've just started the research. But I've got a very capable research assistant at Georgia State, and I'm reading all the cartoons. It started in 1968, and it's been running almost continuously, so there's a lot of comic strips to read. It should be a fun project.
Hey, John, keep us in mind when that comes about, and I really appreciate your time. Thanks again, and I hope you have a great 2014.
Oh, thank you so much. I sure appreciate it. Let's definitely stay in touch.
John McMillan, one more time as we continue with more on the other side after this.